following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
The opening sequence to the film Saving Private Ryan has got to be one of the most intense 25 minutes of footage ever put together. In recreating the D-Day landings, Steven Spielberg set out to help the audience hopefully get a sense of exactly what it was like for those soldiers storming those beaches in Normandy, June 6, 1944. With the ocean at their backs, they had no choice but to keep moving forward, because the only way of stopping the withering fire that was coming at them was to scale the cliffs that were in front of them. And if you've seen the film, you know what it's like. It's almost like you were right there in the action with the bullets whizzing past your face and seeing men on your right and your left cut down by that fire. Now, thank God, most of us will never have the experience of having literal bullets flying over our heads. But mark my words, if you get serious about trying to follow Jesus, you better be prepared to take some metaphorical incoming fire. That's because some people are going to react negatively to your witness. In fact, some people are going to hate you even if you're not actively trying to share the gospel with them. The fact that you exist and that you're trying to live by the teachings of Jesus will be enough to earn the ire of some folks. Because the existence of your values challenges their values, and it makes them very uncomfortable. And sometimes it's because they're under conviction. They're trying to hold God at arm's length. And your presence in your life serves as a reminder of that to them. Now, this incoming fire doesn't have to come always from other human beings either. As people who believe that there's a spiritual unseen world around us, we also understand we have a spiritual enemy. The names given to him in the Bible literally mean, in the Old Testament, the adversary, in the New Testament, the accuser. And the Bible doesn't treat him like some cartoon character out of the medieval imagination. There's nothing in the Bible about some guy in a red suit with horns and a tail carrying a pitchfork. I don't know where we got that, okay? In the Bible, he's taken very seriously as a malevolent spiritual being who is personal, powerful, and cunning. Neither does the Bible talk about his attacks in terms of levitating bodies, spinning heads, and spitting up green pea soup. That's from Hollywood. In the Bible, he's depicted as a master of psychological warfare. And this is how it works. He will rarely attack you directly. Instead, he will come up beside you and whisper in your ear. He will play on your anxieties, your insecurities, and your grievances there. He'll try to discourage you, to depress you, and distract you. He'll try to convince you the gospel is a delusion, that you're a failure, and that maybe, perhaps you really do deserve some payback for all these other people and what they've done for you. He'll try to stir you up against other people, or stir them up against you. A church that's too busy fighting itself is no threat to him or his designs. He will do everything he can to disrupt, divide, or defeat the work that God is trying to do through a local church. That's why in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, the Apostle Paul warns believers to always be ready to forgive each other. Because in Paul's words, quote, so that we may not be taken advantage of by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes. Spiritual warfare, y'all, is real. I've witnessed it. I've experienced it. It is real. And if you're serious about following Jesus, you've experienced it too, even though you may not have recognized it immediately for what it was. Now, the Apostle Paul had experienced his share of spiritual warfare. So did the church at Thessalonica. In his letter to that church, specifically in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, Paul recounts some of his experiences with that harassing fire from the enemy. And he also lays out several things he did to protect himself from those attacks. And in this passage, I think there's 8 keys that you and I could learn from Paul's experience and the experience of the Thessalonian believers. So this morning, we're going to work our way through those 12 verses. And we're going to identify these things and see what Paul and the Thessalonians can teach us as we try to take Jesus seriously and live for Him here in our community in our day. Now, just a little note here. Throughout this, I'm going to be assuming some background information from the first two messages in this series. So if you haven't had a chance to experience those, let me encourage you to go back sometime soon and listen to them on our website at newsalembaptist.net/media. They're there. They're free. And I think you'll find them very helpful. But the first key here that we see in this passage is this. Remember that God defines success differently than the world does. God defines success differently than the world does. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1, we read, "For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain." Paul says, "My coming to you was not in vain." Now, Paul's enemies had tried to argue the opposite. I mean, after all, they managed to chase Paul out of town and interrupt his ministry in Thessalonica. They'd even managed to disrupt Paul's ministry in the town of Berea down the road when they sent people down there to stir up trouble for him. So they're probably feeling pretty good that they have done away with this troublemaker. But even though his ministry in Thessalonica had been cut short, Paul could point to one huge piece of evidence that his work had actually been a success. You care to guess what that evidence was? It was the existence of the Thessalonian church itself. 6 times in 12 verses, Paul appeals to the Thessalonian believers' own experience. Verse 1, he says, "For you yourselves know." In verse 2, "As you know," about his what he'd experienced there in their city. Verse 5, "As you know," he says, they know the manner in which Paul had come and ministered among them. In verse 4, "For you recall all the things that had happened when Paul was there." In verse 10, "You are witnesses." They'd seen it with their own eyes. Verse 11, "Just as you know." So they had their own experience. Paul's ministry in Thessalonica had borne fruit in the faith of the Thessalonian disciples. The fact they had come to faith and responded to faith to what Paul was preaching was proof that Paul's ministry was not in vain. And the fact they had persevered in that faith even after Paul had been run out of town. Remember, the whole point of this letter, Paul's been waiting months to hear what happened to this church, and word finally got back to him, and he found out these guys are not only surviving, they are thriving without his help, only through the grace of God and their perseverance. Paul says, "That's the fruit of my ministry. That proves that this wasn't a mistake. This wasn't a failure." Paul also appealed to God for validation of his ministry in Thessalonica. According to verse 4, Paul understood that it was God who had called him to preach the gospel. It was God who had opened the door for him to preach there in Thessalonica. And Paul believed it was God who validated his ministry by leading all these Thessalonians to believe in Jesus. That's the proof. See, God evaluates our success on the faithfulness of our service and on the fruit of our ministry. We may not have the biggest church. We may not raise the most money. But if we can point to changed lives and the story of people turning to God in faith, that's the fruit God's looking for. We can see people who used to be far away from God that are now walking with God through Jesus Christ. That proves it's not in vain. I think about that a lot myself when I think about my own story. You know, in the moments when I'm having doubt and I'm struggling, I look back over my life. I look over the things I wrestle with now. I look back over where I was headed before God intervened in my life. And I say, man, hey, if Jesus had not stepped in, if I had stayed on the road that I was on, my life would have turned out so much different. And if I didn't have Jesus in my life helping me and strengthening me, some of these things I wrestle with on a low level now might have taken over my life and destroyed it years ago. That's the fruit that shows it's not in vain. So God judges success differently than the world does. Also, be bold in the face of opposition. Verse 2, Paul says, "But after we had already suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know, we had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid much opposition." Often, it's hard to get back in the water once you know there's sharks in there, right? Once you've been bit once, you don't want to go through that again. It's hard to get back in there. But despite the opposition that Paul had faced, Paul refused to give up and shut up. And when one door closed, what did he do? He moved on to the next one. After being asked to leave Philippi, he came to Thessalonica. After being chased out of Thessalonica, he went down the road to Berea. After being forced out of Berea, he went to Athens. After he got laughed out of Athens, he went to Corinth. And in Corinth, he enjoyed in terms of Paul's ministry, a long and fruitful ministry. In fact, he's in Corinth writing this letter back to the Thessalonians at this time. And when he ran into opposition, he didn't fold. He kept doing what God had called him to do. He just looked for another path to do it. Don't allow pushback from the world to silence your witness. Expect opposition. Be ready for it. Be on the lookout for the next opening. To quote the Apostle Peter, always be ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account of the hope that is in you, but with gentleness and respect. Don't waste your time trying to force open a door that's already closed. Look for the person who is willing to listen. And trust in God to give you the strength to persevere. Because as he says, he had boldness in himself? No. He had boldness in our God to speak. It's not your strength that's going to win the day. It's God's strength. Lean on him and look for the openings that he puts before you. The third thing is, testify with integrity. Testify with integrity. In verse 3, for our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit. Actually, Paul's going to touch on this throughout the rest of the paragraph, but let's just stop right here for a second. Let me let you in on what Paul's talking about here. The first century world was full of wandering philosophers and religious teachers who would show up in a community and offer to teach people all about the secret of life for a fee. Okay? Most of these teachers trafficked in what we would consider error. Some were known for seeking to seduce gullible followers into what Paul calls impurity here. In other words, into sexual immorality. Many used manipulative techniques to convince their followers to support them financially. Of course, in our day, we don't know anything about stuff like that, do we? We don't have anybody who does stuff like that around us, do we? In our day, we don't often see wandering teachers coming to our neighborhoods, you know, spreading their questionable teaching or seducing gullible followers or separating people from their money. Now, instead, they just show up on our TVs or on our YouTube feeds. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Paul says, I'm not like that. Some of his Thessalonian critics apparently had tried to slander Paul by accusing him of being one of those hucksters. Oh, don't listen to that guy. He's just not one of those fly-by-night false teachers. But as Paul points out in the next few verses, he sought to insulate himself against charges like that by living a life that was marked by integrity. I know what it's like to have enemies slander you and accuse you falsely. Let me tell you, it is not fun. One of the things I've learned, how you protect yourself on that, is you habitually conduct yourself in such a way that if somebody else starts spreading lies about you, nobody who actually knows you is going to believe it. Because they're going to say, that doesn't sound like the person I know. In fact, that's biblical. Proverbs 26:2 says, like a sparrow in its flitting or a swallow in its flying, so a curse without cause does not come to rest. In other words, you know, people are spreading trash about you. If it's not true, it's probably not going to stick. Of course, this strategy only works if you have consistently conducted yourself honestly and transparently from the beginning. Okay, it's not one of those things you can go back and correct down the road. You got to do this consistently. If you have a reputation for cutting corners and living questionably, you've already defeated yourself. The other strategy for protecting yourself from stuff like this is to let the facts speak for themselves. Again, notice how many times Paul appeals to the Thessalonian believers and their own experience of his ministry. He says, you guys were there. You saw this. You know the kind of person I am. You know I wasn't asking you for money all the time. You know I wasn't fooling around with people on the side. You know I was walking the straight and narrow when I ministered among you, and I was sacrificing to serve you. They knew this. They had witnessed that. So they knew the lies and the slander were false. And again, note how Paul puts himself at God's mercy. I mean, if you're going to say, as God is my witness, if you actually believe in God, that's a tough thing to say, right? Because what if God decides to take you up on that? So live by integrity. Along with that, very closely, is fear God more than man. In verse 4, But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God who examines our hearts. Apparently, some of Paul's critics accused him of being what we would call a ladder climber, that he would say whatever he needed to say to ingratiate himself to the people that he was trying to impress, to those in power. We hear this a lot today. I would not recommend anybody spending much time on the media site formerly known as Twitter. But if you do, you see this a lot, especially in the political realm, where somebody says something that doesn't toe the party line, and people say, oh, you're just trying to get the favor of media elites, or you're just trying to get the favor of the person in the White House, or you're just trying to get the favor of a bunch of congressmen or whatever. You know, and again, this comes from both sides. But it's the same kind of thing that Paul was fighting here in with the Thessalonians. And to refute that accusation, all somebody had to do was look at Paul's track record. Would a person who was seeking to please men do the things that repeatedly got him run out of town? Huh? I mean, he must not be doing very well if he's trying to ingratiate himself to the powers that be because they kept chasing him away. Or is it more likely that a person would be willing to endure such opposition because he really believed the message he was proclaiming and that it was from God? Sometimes God blesses certain individuals with the opportunity to influence a large number of people, okay? But building a big church is not always a sign of gospel faithfulness. That's not to say all big churches are bad. I've known some great churches and some great pastors. But that doesn't automatically mean they have God's hand on them or they're pleasing the Lord with the way they do ministry, okay? Be very anxious if your focus is to gather a whole bunch of your own followers, if you're trying to build your own platform, or if you're trying to grow your own kingdom. Because a focus like that is incompatible with true Christian discipleship. I mean, Jesus, when he said, if anyone wants to come after me, what did he say? You have to deny yourself, okay? You got to take up a cross. That means pretty much a one-way trip. You're willing to die to everything for the sake of Jesus. And he says, you got to follow me. In Matthew 6:33, Jesus said, we are called to seek first God's kingdom, not our kingdom, right? If you're more concerned with the praise of men than the approval of God, then that's all you're going to get. Because in the end, God's opinion is the only one that really matters. So best be sure that you're playing to that audience and not to the rest of the world. Fear God over men. Fifth, minister with pure motives. In verse 5, for we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is our witness. Nor do we seek glory from men, neither from you or from others, even though as apostles of Christ we might have asserted our authority. Paul asserts that his ministry was not based on a desire for greed or for glory, contrary to what some of these other traveling teachers were seeking. Instead, his goal was to represent Christ well as an ambassador by calling lost people to receive redemption through Jesus. While serving in ministry, it's necessary to check your own motivations. And that's true whether you're a pastor, whether you're a Sunday school teacher, whether you're a deacon, whether you serve on a committee, whether you're a door greeter, whatever. If you're serving out of a desire for reward or recognition, you're serving for the wrong reasons. You want to know how you know if you're serving for those things? What's your attitude like when you don't get it? Somebody forgets to say hi or thank you? Does it make you stew? Or are you just glad to be there serving other people in Jesus' name? If recognition and reward are all that you are serving for, then eventually you're either going to burn out or you're going to flame out. So check your motivations. Why do you want to serve? Instead, our motivation for service should not be for glory, should not be for gain. It must always be centered on knowing Christ and making Him known. That's where our joy should be found. Along with that, treat others with gentleness and compassion. In verse 7, but we prove to be gentle among you, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children, having so fond an affection for you that we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you have become very dear to us. And then he jumped down to verse 11. He says, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. One of the things I have learned over the years in studying leadership is that, unfortunately, a lot of people, when they get their first taste of leadership, they fall back on what I call the Arlie Ermey method. For those of you who don't know who Arlie Ermey was, he was a former Marine drill instructor, became a technical advisor to a lot of Hollywood films, and then got his big break for his role as Gunnery Sergeant Hartman in the 1987 film Full Metal Jacket with Stanley Kubrick as the director. Ermey stole the show. He had more lines than anybody else in that entire movie, even though he's only in a little less than half of it. But he had these very creative and over-the-top tirades as the drill sergeant addressing these recruits that were under his care and under his training. And that kind of performance might be appropriate in molding civilians into soldiers. I don't know. I think personally maybe it's a little over the top. Some of you who've been through it, you can tell me otherwise. But I'm not sure it translates very well into everyday life. And unfortunately, that kind of bluster and bullying is what a lot of people think about when they think about leadership. And so they get a position of leadership and they think they got to crack the whip on everybody and they got to be that kind of leader. Well, that's a very particular context. That's not how things actually work most of the time. Okay? And if you try to lead other people like that, yeah, you may have some success for a while, but you're going to be pushing people. You're not going to be leading them. There's a difference. And that's one of the hardest initial leadership lessons for a lot of people to learn. You know, as an apostle, Paul could have asserted his authority. He could have said, hey, don't you folks know who I am? I was handpicked by Jesus. He sent me out to start churches like yours. While I'm here ministering, you really need to help me out. I need a place to stay. I need something to eat. I don't need to be worried about stuff like this. I need to have these taken care of so I can put all my energy in helping this church get started. But Paul did not do that. Instead, Paul used two very familiar metaphors to remind the Thessalonians of how he treated them during his time with them. One was a nursing mother who very gently and tenderly cares for her own children. He said, don't you guys remember, that's how I treated you. That's a very different image than the big tough drill sergeant gets in your face, right? And then he compared himself to a loving father. You know, dad's discipline, right? A loving father disciplines for the purpose of helping their children to grow. He encourages his children. He calls out the best out of them. That's what an exhortation means, to call out the best. Yeah, it's got a little bit of a tough edge to it, but it's an edge with a purpose. Not to tear somebody down, but to build them up. Paul says, that's how I was among you. Another lesson I've learned from leadership years ago, which I found to be true repeatedly, and I don't have any idea who first said this. I know where I got it from, but I don't know if they originated it. But it's this. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I don't care how many degrees you got, how smart you are, how well you put two words together, how many positions you've held, how far up the ladder you've climbed. That only gets you so far. You want people to really follow you? Convince them that you truly love them. And I have seen this happen. Some of the people that I would consider my biggest fans, you know, I use that word loosely in this church, are people who I've walked some dark valleys with, you know, through the death of a spouse, loss of a child, some medical crisis. You know, and it's tough doing that. I mean, because as a pastor today, there's always all kinds of demands on your time. But it's those people who you walk through those dark valleys with who will march over broken glass for you. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's the model that Paul puts out for us. And isn't that so different than the model of leadership that the world so often holds out to us? The person cracking the whip and pushing and you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out. And Paul says, in the church, it's going to be different. We're going to model Jesus. And Jesus was the good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep. That's our model for leadership. Number 7, this is important. Strive to carry your own weight. Going back to what Paul should have been able to demand from this church. He goes on to say, for you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship. how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave towards you believers. Again, as an apostle, Paul could have expected the Thessalonian church to provide him lodging and income while he was there ministering in their midst. But instead, Paul didn't accept a dime from them. Instead, he set up a business, a side business, and supported himself while ministering among them. Most likely, he set up a business making tents. We know he was a tent maker by trade, in addition to his theological background. But think about that. Working all day long, from sunrise to sunset, and then devoting the evenings to teaching and ministering there among the Thessalonians. Now, there are some situations where that's called bivocational ministry, and there's some situations that makes a lot of sense. But I'm very thankful that this church makes it possible for me to devote myself to ministry full time. As I said, being a pastor these days, and I've seen it change dramatically in the last 30 years I've been doing this, there's so many different kinds of demands that are placed on pastors today. We're expected to be, you know, a great preacher and a master CEO and a wonderful counselor and all these different roles. And it can get spread a little thin. I think about, you know, as thin as I feel spread sometime these days, how much worse it would be if I had to go out and work another job just to feed my family so then I could minister to you. So thank you so much for what you do to allow me to devote myself to you full time and to be able to be available as much as I can. Providing for those in ministry has a long pedigree in the scriptures, okay? Under the Mosaic Law, a portion of certain sacrifices was given to the priests to help them feed their families. Paul himself would teach churches, "You shall not muzzle the ox while it is threshing, and the labor is worthy of his wages." That's from 1 Timothy 5, verse 18. Paul's point has application beyond those who serve church vocationally. You may say, "Well, pastor, that's fine for pastors. What about the rest of us?" Don't be the kind of Christian who gets the reputation for sponging off everybody else. All right? That's the point. If you want to protect yourself against enemy fire, pull your own weight. Be willing to get your hands dirty. Seek to be a blessing, not a burden. One of what I count one of the greatest compliments I've ever received as a pastor came from one of our older laymen after a church fellowship. If I mentioned the name, some of y'all would say, "Yeah, that sounds just like him." But I forget what it was, some event where a meal was involved, and afterwards, me and some of the other men were picking up plates and putting away trash and stuff. And I noticed this guy, this older gentleman, just kind of standing there in the corner watching. Really didn't think much of it. I happened to pass close to him to get to the trash cans, and he said, "Let me talk to you a second." I said, "Okay." He said, "I've been watching you." And all of a sudden, it got me a little nervous. Then he said, "You know what? A lot of preachers wouldn't be doing this." I'm like, "I don't know why not. I mean, it needs to be done. You know, we're just cleaning up." But I got to thinking, you know, what an indictment against people who stand where I stand normally. It's not so much a praise of me as an indictment against those who think being a leader makes you exempt from doing the dirty work. That's not the way I was raised, sorry. But don't be the kind of person who says, "That's not my job." And that goes true for a volunteer as much as it does for a senior pastor. Listen, I don't know, again, this is a statement I picked up over the years. I don't know who said it first, but I think it's true. If service is beneath you, leadership is beyond you. Okay? We are called to serve one another. And there's not one of us that's so high and mighty that we don't need to get our hands dirty at times. Be a servant. Be willing to carry your own load. And then finally this, represent well the one who sends you. In verse 12, he says, "So that you would walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory." Paul's wish for the Thessalonian disciples was to imitate his example and walk worthy of the God who calls you. Now, don't misunderstand Paul's meaning here. He's not saying that we can ever truly be worthy of God's calling. What he means is once we have responded to that calling, that gracious invitation, and we bear the name of God, then we should strive to represent that name well. It's a heavy thing to realize that other people may be making judgments about God by what they see in you. I don't know about you, but that keeps me up at night sometimes. Strive to always conduct yourself in a way that draws people to God and doesn't push them away from Him. A while back I saw a video, it was about it was a little historical thing about one of the military operations our nation has been involved in, and it showed as the U.S. military was getting ready to withdraw from this area, they were collecting all their unused ammunition and equipment, and they were burning it. And somebody might say, what? That doesn't make sense. I mean, that stuff costs money. Why not just gather it up and take it with you? Well, the calculation is that this stuff, it would cost more to ship it out than it would to replace it. But the one thing they couldn't do was leave it there, because then the enemy might get it and might use it to shoot some of our soldiers. So they were destroying it. Now here's the point I'm trying to make with that, okay? When you get serious about following Jesus, you can't stop other people from attacking you for that choice. But you don't have to supply them with the ammunition. Okay? Strive to serve Jesus with boldness, with integrity, and with love. And you will dodge a lot of fire the enemy sends your way. You will insulate yourself from a lot of those attacks. And you will help to continue gaining gospel ground, even under fire.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.